Hi there, folks. Welcome once more into the minefield. Wonderful to have your company here as we try to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is his.
Yeah, talk about minefields. Online shaming, Waleed. I mean, this is something that really has been... We've talked about it quite a lot. And it's something that if you are pretty much alive in any way, whether you're on Twitter or Facebook or not, you'll see on newspapers, in news stories, on television shows, people being disgraced online or some sort of social media campaign intended to point the finger at some prominent person and say, look what this person did. Look how unjust it is. Let's play for you a very interesting recent example of this.
Come home, Cardinal Pell. I know you're not feeling well, and being crook ain't much fun. Even so, we think you should come home, Cardinal Pell. Come down from your citadel. It's just the right thing to do. We have a right to know what you knew.
Tim Minchin, of course. Probably heard that many, many times last week, and you only need to hear it once because it's not leaving your head. It's just one of the... Say what you want about that song, Scott. Incredibly well written, musically and lyrically, incredibly well composed. But it raised a lot of divergent responses, gave a lot of survivors a lot of hope, but also triggered a counter-response that said this was unduly aggressive and sort of just turning Cardinal Pell unjustly into the victim of a witch hunt and a kind of villain. What I want to interrogate here is actually not that song or even Cardinal Pell specifically, but as you mentioned before, the broader phenomenon here of how when someone puts an intervention like that, irrespective actually of their intentions, or even of what's in the work itself, but any intervention like that, it creates a kind of momentum in a certain direction, and that direction always seems to be in the mode of a pylon. And the people have written quite a lot about this, lots of famous examples of that. I think, was it Justine Succo, the woman's name, who tweeted, effectively was trying to make a point about white privilege and AIDS in Africa and was taken the wrong way as saying something racist and had her life pretty much destroyed by the time she landed in South Africa. She tweeted it before she got on a plane, and this all blew up while she was in the air and then suddenly got landed and was in all sorts of trouble. We're seeing more and more of these examples. But I want to say something else as well, Scott, because I feel like there is another phenomenon that goes along with this simultaneously, and that is also the demand from individual people not to be shamed for certain things. So we've had, for example, the recent cultural phenomenon of calling people out for their slut-shaming or their fat-shaming and so on and so forth. So at the same time as we have this resistance to the very idea that people should be shamed for things... We then have this other move, which is the more and more of this kind of shaming goes on. And I want to try to disentangle that today, and I'll let you decide where you want to start.
Oh, wow. It's kind of equal opportunity shaming, isn't it?
Sort of, yeah.
And it's equal opportunity shaming that's then producing an equal and opposite response. Look, I should say, Willie, that I did misspeak before we played Tim Minchin's song. I said that oftentimes shaming is about big and powerful people that are then being disgraced in the public sphere. Actually, it's not that at all, is it? I mean, it's oftentimes, and you often get, you know, the moves of online shaming that receive the greatest publicity often have to do with high profile figures. But what you just described is absolutely right. There are people who might have said something that placed them on the wrong side of history, or that it's taken the wrong way, or might actually simply be something that is absolutely vile, but the person is relatively anonymous, and then there you have it. Their lives are anonymous no longer. And so I think, I mean, it really is a very complex phenomenon. My read of the situation is that if you've been involved in a pile-on, in other words, you've been one of the ones who's piled on in an act of righteous indignation, then you probably don't think shaming is necessarily a bad thing. If you've in any way copped it, you think it's a terrible and unjust and unfair thing.
Do you know what? I'm going to make that more complex, though, because I suspect a lot of people who would stand up and say, how dare you fat shame them or me or whatever, might also be the same people that are prepared to jump on shaming a public figure in the way that Cardinal Pell was shamed over the past week, for example. I don't think it's as simple as that. I suspect there is... I'm going to try to explain this apparent incoherence with reference to one concept, and you can take it or disagree with me,
okay,
Scott. But I think it all comes down basically to power. and politics. So, the person who is saying, how dare you fat shame me, or how dare you slut shame me, or whatever it might be, is saying, I am in a disempowered position. I belong to a group that has been shamed and disempowered by mainstream society for a very long time. Now social media, in that, in those sorts of cases, gives me the ability to talk back and say that your shaming is an abuse of power and I will no longer accept it. But when I shame someone like, I don't know, a politician or a cardinal or whatever it is, then that's an inversion of that power. So what I'm then doing is I'm allowing those who were previously voiceless suddenly to have within themselves the power to shame those who were previously unshameable because conventional power made it so.
For all those listeners out there who are sort of gearing up for the minefield drinking game, and every time Waleed says politics or power, they have a drink, you know what's coming next.
Aristotle, come on.
Well, okay. I don't think what you say is entirely without merit. I do think that online shaming or public shaming is a symptom of antagonism. It's a symptom of feelings of either disempowerment or historical disenfranchisement. I think there probably are other things that end up being bound with it as well. Things like wanting to be seen to be on the right side of history, for instance. So
performing virtue.
This is a kind of moral vanity. But look, Wally, let me take your suggestion seriously. I don't want to win the argument, as I so often do. I don't want to win the argument just by changing the vernacular in which we're speaking. Let me take your politics point very seriously, because I do think it's right what this is an expression of and how we can square this circle, how it is that someone who might object to themselves being shamed can then turn around and shame someone else. But let me go deeper into it. I would suggest to you, Waleed, that when it all comes down to it, public shaming, online shaming, is a subspecies of anger. I mean, you would have noticed, for instance, that, you know, words like outrage are now everywhere in social media. Yep. If you feel outraged about something, and even social media itself is increasingly a conduit for an emotion that, when it comes down to it, we actually don't see expressed very much in everyday life. I mean, you don't often see people outside, say, the domestic setting getting angry. But social media, it's saturated in it. It's marinating in discontent and in anger.
And so is traditional media. We should say as well.
Yes. But interestingly enough, with traditional media, that anger was of a very particular form. It was almost a kind of performance art. It was vicarious anger, wasn't it? It was, you feel outraged, let me channel your outrage for you. Let me reflect it back to you. We still see that often when we hear politicians, when it's demanded of politicians, to get angry about something or to express their fury. But I think that with social media, it's something rather different. Here's what I would suggest, and let me acknowledge my full indebtedness here to Aristotle, surprise, surprise. Aristotle had this really interesting idea that anger is itself a kind of lust, a kind of desire for retaliation. Retaliation as something that would bring an injustice to rights. In other words, you might feel that you've been wronged, that you've been downranked, that you've been dishonored. Or you might feel that someone who you know, or someone or a cause that you deeply believe in has been downranked, or maybe a traditional dishonor or a traditional downranking is being perpetuated by something that some people say. Anger then kicks into play as a desire for two things, for that wrong to be righted, for the historical balance, if you like, to be equalized. But also, and this is what Aristotle said that I think is absolutely right, you can't separate the longing for retaliation from the expression of anger. And he said, because of that, because retaliation is bound up with anger, it is a sterile emotion. Now, I really like this, Waleed, because Aristotle's fundamental point is that anger can't produce anything beyond itself. It can emote. It can generate likewise or corresponding feelings of resentment or anger. It can shame. It can create resentment. But it can't produce anything constructive out the other side. In other words, it's politically sterile. So if you want to say that this is a political gesture or it's something that actually comes down to a kind of political grievance, I would say yes, but it's an ill-formed one. It's a deranged political expression that can't produce anything productive, either by way of reconciliation or understanding or sympathy or empathy out the other side.
Yeah, see, the problem with this is that Aristotle was a moron. No, of course I don't mean that. I just felt like saying it. I think there is truth to that, but I also think it overlooks that there is something still productive, or there can be something productive about anger. I agree. It is not fully formed. It is emotional by definition. Anger
is
emotional.
It's a moral intuition, isn't it? It's something that just says in you, this is wrong and something should be done about it.
Right, which means that at some level, on some level, it is morally informed.
That's right.
Right. And so the desire to shame, the reason I think it's really important to link it with power, and by the way, I'm not particularly for anger. I don't think it's a morally superior way of behaving, but I don't think it's morally bereft.
Mm.
And I'm not for shaming either. I believe that sort of mode of discourse ruins the possibilities of civic discourse.
Okay.
But in terms of understanding, or as a way of understanding it, I think the role of power is so important because it flows from those who feel there is simply no other avenue. I've been agitating this privately for ages, for years, for my entire life, whatever it might be. I simply have no platform for it. The courts won't listen to me. The mainstream media won't listen to me because I'm a woman or I'm gay or I'm black or whatever it might be. The institutions of power are arrayed against me. And there is simply no option that I have now except to emote in this way, start a racket. And that will then attract it and shift the conversation. It's kind of a mode of disruption, which is why I think the online shaming element is interesting, because it typically, not exclusively, but typically flows in the opposite direction of conventional power. And that's why I think conventional power is so important to understanding what we're witnessing. So I don't disagree with Aristotle's diagnosis, but you stop short if you say that's enough kind of to say, so this shaming thing is kind of a bit, you know, silly and pointless.
Yeah, no, look, I wasn't saying that it was silly and pointless, and I do completely accept what you just described. I think that's right, and I think understanding anger as a moral intuition or something that comes out of the moral intuitions, I think that's right. In other words, anger, to some extent at least, tells you the truth about an historical wrong. But there's a huge difference between turning anger into something constructive, what Martha Nussbaum refers to as transitional anger. Anger might raise awareness about something, it might orient me towards something, it might mobilize me to do something, but it has to translate into something else. Anger has to leave itself behind. There's a huge difference, I'm sure you'd agree with this, Willie, there's a huge difference between transitional anger and the kind of fickleness that we often see online, where some huge ruckus has been started, everyone has just gone out emoting, and then once someone's life has been destroyed, or once these feelings have been expunged, then they move on to something else.
I agree. That seems
to me is the perfect encapsulation of the sterility of anger as such.
I agree there's a huge difference. I don't think they're discrete, though. I think there's an overlap, and I think we need to acknowledge that. Anyway, you're listening to The Mindfield. Leave a comment on our website if you wish. RN The Mindfield, preferably just one visceral with rage. Or you can tweet us at RN The Mindfield. Now, Scott, we have some help from someone who actually knows what they're talking about.
Yes, who actually knows something about the internet, which, you know, neither Waleed or I do. Irina Reku is director of the Internet Ethics Program at Markkula Center of Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University. She's thought very deeply. She's one of the rare kind of internet people who's actually thought very deeply about matters of justice and ethics online. Irina, I do have to ask you, you know, shaming. I grew up reading Nathaniel Hawthorne's Scarlet Letter. You know, shaming is nothing new. Pulling someone out into the public square and making fun of them, that's nothing new. Are we just seeing something that's on a bigger scale here with online shaming? Or is there something actually new with what's going on in social media at the moment?
The effects, if nothing else, the effects are new. So I think that changes the whole calculus around online shaming. The scale is new. When there was public shaming before, I mean, there was a certain limited public who saw it.
There was also a relationship there, though, wasn't there? There's also a relationship with the person being shamed.
The whole context. But I mean, but just in terms of the scale of the shaming, there was a certain group who knew of it. It wasn't an international scope like we have now. I mean, if you are on Twitter, you can be shamed by people from around the world. That was never the case before. The duration is different. You know, people would be in the stocks for a certain amount of time and then they would be left out, or you could move away if it was bad enough and it wasn't going away. Now with the internet, you might be marked forever as the person who said that one really stupid thing. And that history can trail you forever. Those make it different. It's not the same phenomenon. And the other thing you mentioned too is the lack of context. The fact that we can misunderstand each other. It might not be shaming over something that's really warranted. And people keep saying that. People who have been on the receiving end of this kind of shaming say, well, that's not what I meant. I was being sarcastic, or it was a joke, or you don't really know, you know, in the, you know, you picked out one tweet from a long conversation. That's different than the kind of shaming that you're describing. I would also push back. I mean, you said, well, you know, we're aware of scarlet letters and all of these things, but we hadn't done those for a while, have we? There was that gap there. So I would ask, why did most modern societies move away from public shaming?
So, Irina, this is why I think I rely on the crutch of power to explain this. We did away with public shaming as a form of punishment because we're still then talking in the realm of punishment from institutions of power. It's become revived as something that we do precisely because it's not something, like, it's like a gap in the range of punishments we have available now upon people who do have power. So I'm sorry to harp on about this, and feel free to tell me I'm barking completely up the wrong tree here, but that's why I feel like it's such a central element to try to understand the social phenomena we're observing.
Yeah, and I think that power is absolutely a key issue here. And I understand why people are rooting sometimes for those who start the shaming. But I would say in terms of the imbalance of power, what's interesting is there might be one imbalance of power at the beginning, and then by the time there's a whole mob behind the initial person starting the shaming, the balance of power or the imbalance might change the other way. And so it's one thing if it's a very public figure, a very powerful figure whom even, you know, non-social media would have exposed before. I think part of the problem is that we're mixing a lot of things together. So I was trying to figure out what is the kind of online shaming that bothers me the most. And I was thinking it's not the journalistic kind of exposure of wrongdoing by public figures. That one seems like the common good is served by that.
Sort of. And, so it's not very journalistic in the way that it's done. That's the other thing
right,
we should acknowledge.
Although, again, I think so I think the power differential makes a difference there. I also don't think I would put, although a lot of people file under online shaming, this phenomenon of doxing. Doxing is when people start out by being mad at somebody, and what they do is they end up releasing that person's personal information or information about their family, and you know those people end up getting death threats. So I think that that's something other than online shaming, but sometimes it gets kind of blended into the conversation about online shaming. And I would also say that it's different from criticism of a particular argument or a point. I think you can have disagreements with people about something that they say, but online shaming often becomes a personal attack on the whole person. Like, you are just a bad person for having said something. And that's where it loses me, too. So it creates this sort of sense in which I don't think it's even helpful anymore, right? It's one thing to try to change somebody's mind. It's another to just pile on and say you're a horrible person. Is that really going to make them better? Is that going to be effective? How is that serving us as a society?
And this is actually one of the really curious dimensions, I think, of online shaming, that, you know, we are interacting with people that we do not know. There's a kind of depersonalization of our social interactions through social media. And yet at the same time, the way that we actually engage with people is on a far more almost hyper-personal level than we would in normal everyday life. But I also just wanted to ask you, Irina, about, you know, one of the other things that does strike me as new about what we're seeing now is what might be called kind of third-party anger or third-party retaliation. So one person might have a grievance against somebody. I would think, for instance, about a prominent, say, a prominent woman who has been receiving violent or overly, you know, sort of violently sexualized messages or threats or whatever, and then decides to address that power differential by making this person public. Okay, that I think is probably morally justifiable. I would need to think about that a bit further. But then the huge pile-on afterwards by sympathetic third parties. I mean, what's going on there? Is that morally problematic?
I think so, in part because, as I was saying, I think it changes the whole balance of power. And suddenly, with some of these examples, you start to feel bad for whoever is the target of the mob because of this, I don't know if it's a sterile attack, but it does seem not well thought out in the first place, and without a particular goal in mind. I mean, is it really to change the person who said whatever it was? Is it to deter other people? Is it to show society that such things, so that's one of the arguments that's been made, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if I don't make this public, people will say that such things don't happen anymore, for example. I think that's why a lot of people, including myself, are conflicted sometimes about this, because there are all a variety of circumstances, and sometimes you feel they're justified, but often when it's directed at some individual who said something stupid, it's so disproportionate that even if there was some, you know, some good reason at the beginning, it loses that along the way.
But I actually think that it's quite easy to explain the moral logic of doing it. I don't agree with this, by the way, but I can understand that what it's trying to do is reset the social norms. So if someone is getting so disproportionately punished because they said something racist, for example, that's sending a broader message to society that racism is a really, really bad thing in a way that, and on a scale you perhaps didn't understand before. So the person who gets shamed and whose life may even be destroyed as a result of it, totally disproportionately, is some kind of sacrificial lamb in the process.
Well, yeah, hang on though, Waleed, because there is something morally defensible about that, though. Because, I mean, one thoroughly reputable form of moral education is that you change people's behavior first, and then you hope that as the result of that change of behavior, the values, if you like, that are represented by that change of behavior begin trickling their way onto the inside. I suppose my problem with it, my question about it would be, okay, that may well outlaw certain forms of behavior, but in the very act of expressing disapproval, does it, if you like, you know, to use the image I used before, does it sort of sterilize the capacity of that person to then be left to led to the next rehabilitative level?
Yeah, it sterilizes that person. But I don't think the aim is that person. I think the aim is broader society, to the extent that this is theorized at all. I think perhaps what we're talking about, Arena, and just to finish, I mean, is this the issue that we're dealing with? That people who are actually not very powerful, but who nonetheless have transgressed within the logic of power. So they're people, white people lacking in power who say something racist about black people. So there's a power dynamic, but they themselves as individuals are not powerful. They're disempowered, but they become avatars of power. Hmm. And so the pile-on sort of is justified because of that, while we overlook that there's actually an individual here who has no say in this, whose life is being disproportionately destroyed.
Well, I think that would be unethical. I think that destroying an individual for the sake of making some broader point, when that response is disproportionate, is not an ethical response.
And that's where we are, though, isn't it?
There are different schools of thought, right? You can say from a utilitarian point of view, it might be, you know, a good outcome. But if you look at individual rights and at justice, it doesn't sound like a just outcome to me. And I think even in terms of the broader societal, I mean, I understand what you're saying, that you're sending that let's say that sort of wave of shame sends a message to not so much to the person being shamed, but to others. But sometimes it seems to be triggered so randomly. I mean, if somebody says something egregiously racist, they probably know that they're going to get some pushback on it. But sometimes it's not very obvious statements. And, you know, it makes me think of the golden rule, Would you want to be judged by one stupid thing? We've all said something that is either outright bad or could be misinterpreted or taken out of context.
I think that's a point well made, and I better wrap up before we all say something stupid because the news is about to descend upon us.
I worry about that
all
the time. But I
indeed, Irina, we do have to run. I'm so sorry about that. But thank you very much for joining us today. That's Irina Raikou, Director of the Internet Ethics Program at the Markler Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University in California. We're done for another week on The Mindfield. We'll see you next.
The smartphone is becoming the device that is like the Swiss Army knife of digital life.
Lee Rainey from the Pew Research Centre, among our guests on Future Tense, to give us a bit of a call of the board on where our technology use is heading. We'll also be joined by a privacy commissioner, a computer scientist turned online artist, and a writer with an obsession about being in other people's photos. Future Tense. Download the program from the RN website, find us via the ABC Radio app, or look for us on iTunes.